Sharon Bryan is the author of the poetry collections Salt Air, Objects of Affection, Flying Blind, and most recently Sharp Stars, which won the Isabella Stewart Gardner Poetry Award. She is editor of Where We Stand, Women Poets on the Literary Tradition, and Planet on the Table, Poets on the Reading Life, which she co-edited with William Olson. She has been a visiting professor at the University of Connecticut and Dartmouth College and is currently teaching graduate seminars at Emerson College in Boston. Thank you, Sharon, for being on the show.
Welcome.
I'm delighted to be here. I like the title. I don't know if you had Leonard Cohen in mind.
No, I don't think we did.
No, but you know what? Now that you mention it, I love Leonard Cohen.
Well, and he has that wonderful song, Birds on a Wire.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. No, we use, for our theme song, we use Some Upon the Higher Wire.
Right. Yeah, I actually heard it when I listened to the Phil Levine interview you did, which was wonderful.
Oh, cool. Thanks. Yeah. And I would like to start off, first of all, making sure you're okay. You're in Boston right now, and the storm Sandy is, as we record this, is playing havoc on the East Coast. Everything's okay in Boston, though, I understand.
Yeah, it's actually past us, and it was more, the worst part here was the nonstop coverage. It was really boring after a while. but it sounds awful in New York.
Yeah,
I was just last night, I reread this wonderful essay by E.B. White called The Eye of Edna. And even though he wrote it in the 50s, it was incredibly familiar because he's living in Maine and there's this huge hurricane coming up the coast and he's listening on the radio. And it's much worse on the radio than ever. And it doesn't match up. By the time it gets to him, of course, they're way on to other things on the radio and when trees are blowing down in his yard in Maine. So.
Are you inspired by the storm in any way to write model in poetry?
No.
That's probably good.
I mean, not that I can tell, unless it's very delayed and indirect. No, I mean, I feel I have friends in New York and New Jersey that I've been touching base with, but so it's a very big deal in New York.
Yeah, absolutely.
Horrible.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about Sharp Stars.
Okay.
That's your latest book. It's put out by BOA. I'm going to start off by telling you what I love about your poetry and specifically in this book.
Right?
I love your syntax. I love how your sentences carry us all the way to the very end before they drop even a hint of sentido or completion. It makes the poem so effortless to read. You just follow the sentence, and you don't know where it's going to go, and then it lets you off. And it's that ambiguity in between as you're getting to the end of the sentence where a lot of the poetry happens. You must love writing sentences.
What you said is really interesting to me because I never thought about it quite that way. I know there was a point where I started postponing ending the sentence. I mean, not even that consciously, and using a lot more commas and dashes as a way to resist the sentence, I think. And in fact, somebody just sent me an anthology called One for the Money, The Sentence as a Poetic Form, where all the poems in it are a single sentence. And it includes a poem from Sharp Stars called White Space.
Oh, yes, I like that poem.
And the truth is I hadn't really noticed that it was one sentence, but it is. And I think it is something about the postponement, not wanting to stop.
Yeah, in fiction we call it writing suspenseful or periodic sentences where, you know, you don't reveal the heart of the sentence in the first clause. You kind of keep it, and then you know,
exactly.
and it drives the forward.
Maybe that's in the back of my mind someplace, because I mean, Proust is a big favorite, because he does those sentences.
Do you sometimes not know where the sentence is going to go, and you just kind of have faith and follow it?
I would say never.
Really?
Yeah, that's a lot of the pleasure of writing for me, is that I really feel like I'm listening and writing down what the poem tells me to. And, I mean, when I'm not doing that, if I'm just talking, it's bad.
Right.
I don't like the sound of my own voice.
Uh-huh.
So I'm waiting. And it does interrupt, you know, when you're working on a draft. and you don't know where to go next, then my voice starts to talk, and that's never very interesting. The poem, I feel like, knows so much more than I do. That's what I want to get down. So no, I don't know where it's going. That's the pleasure.
Yeah, in the poem called Poem, you write, "I don't know what I am or what I want until I hear myself say it to her." And, of course, you're speaking to the poem itself in that line. Does speaking the poem help you figure things out?
Oh, totally. Totally. I think somewhere in the back of my mind when I wrote that was my wonderful Uncle Don, who died a few years ago. And whenever we'd all go out to dinner together and somebody would say to him, "What are you going to have?" he would say, "I don't know till I hear myself order it." and I feel like that, and I feel like often, in fact, if I do sometimes have a sense of where, of what I believe or think, a lot of times the poem just turns on me and makes me realize, oh no, I don't really believe that. I can't. There's something about truth-telling in poems. Not the facts, but other kinds of truth. That's where I can most tell what it is, what's accurate, so that if I try to just put something in a poem that's there are times when I think I know where it's going, and then the poem just spits that out.
Well, I think it's interesting because I think that as I hear you talk and I think about your poems, then it sounds like you put two opposite things. You're trying to put two opposite things together and then hold them both at once. It sounds like you lose yourself in words and then find yourself in them.
That's a wonderful description. I can't imagine a better description of writing poems.
Yeah, and I think about your poem, Bad Days.
Yeah.
Which I love that poem.
Oh.
And I think it could have been this incredibly misanthropic poem, and yet it isn't.
Really? You don't think it is in places?
But overall, no, the overall, of course it is in places, of course. But I don't think the poem is actually saying, we should have never been born. We should have never been. I think the poem is actually saying, oddly enough, we should take a look at our own history and maybe start again in a place where you end the poem. It says, before farming, before we lived in caves or spoke or discovered fire, lift us off our feet and into the trees and leave us there, harmlessly eating fruit, not even poking anthills with bits of straw. Before any discovery at all, so maybe you want to get us back to some kind of original innocence. And I love that impulse. It's very generous at the end of this poem. How did you write that poem?
I think it's sort of an unusual poem for me, though I kind of think I'm going to be writing more. Anger's never been a big driving force in poems for me. I've never known how to write out of it. But there are several angry poems in this book. And, like Barking Dog is where I complain about.
Oh, that's a fun poem.
That was written in Fresno.
Oh, really? That's right. You were the visiting distinguished writer at Fresno State for a semester.
Yeah, my favorite teaching job ever.
Wow.
And
I did that gig. It was great.
I had wonderful students, and the community of writers was great there. But
Sasha was one of your students.
Yes.
Sasha Pimentel Chacon, and she talks very highly of you.
Well, she was one of the very best students, and she was in a wonderful, magical class that just was the kind of thing that keeps you wanting to teach forever. But the anger in this poem is fear. You know, that's something I haven't written a lot out of. And there are days when I do just despair, that when I actually find myself wishing that, when I feel like humans are going to destroy the planet, and given a choice, I'd rather we destroyed ourselves first. You know?
Exactly.
But it breaks my heart. Maybe that's what comes through in the end, that finally overwhelms the anger, is the sadness.
Yes.
It's just heartbreaking. That I kind of can't believe it, that we would do that.
Do did you begin writing poetry? Because you seem to be such an incredibly empathetic person, and it comes through in the poems, to kind of keep your empathy from overwhelming you?
Wow. I never, ever thought of that. But I didn't, but it really makes sense. I started writing when I was a little kid, and it came partly because all these, my grandmother, my great aunts, all sort of spoke in poetry for one. You know, they did all the little Lazy Mary, Will You Get Up, and they said all the nursery rhymes as part of life, and they also read poetry to me. But I did have that sense of kind of every, I mean, I used to pick up leaves on the playground. There I was in the outfield praying no balls would come to me, you know, and kind of wandering around out there, and I would pick up dead leaves because I felt sorry for them and put them in my pocket, and then when my mom did the laundry, she would be saying, what's all this? So there was a way that things were kind of excruciating to me, both in good ways and bad ways, sad ways. And maybe I did, maybe that was part of the impulse.
We're talking to Sharon Bryan, whose book, Sharp Stars, is available from Boa Editions. And you made reference to a poem you called Barking Dog in this collection, Sharp Stars. And in this poem, the speaker of the poem is trying to write a poem, but a dog, neighbor dog, is barking and barking and barking, and finally that she just lets the barking dog into the poem, and the barking dog runs around and pees on the stanzas and the sentences. I don't see a lot of anger in that. I see a lot of humor in that. And I also wondering if it seems to for you that the poetry, or at least for the speakers of your poem, poems, writing poems is a way to kind of, it's like a retreat. It's a place to go where it's silent and where you can figure things out. But I imagine a lot of times that those things that are encroaching on that silence can become part of the tension of the poem itself.
I think they do. I mean, because sometimes it's not a barking dog. It's thoughts. It's thoughts about other stuff and that you're trying to keep out. And of course, that's exactly then what powers the poem in some ways.
Right.
It's whatever you're trying to look away from.
Yeah, it's almost as if, I forget the writer's name, but he was a theologian who used to say, I used to get really angry at my interruptions until I discovered that the interruptions were my work.
Oh, wow.
And
that's perfect.
Yeah, and that's, I think, what you're talking about now, that we have to listen to the barking dogs in whatever form they take because they're saying something important.
Yes, and if they're taking up part of our brains, there's a reason.
Right.
You know, and you can't. I do have this fantasy of just being in a quiet room, sort of in a convent, you know? But it's really hard to get to that.
Yes, get good luck on that one.
Yeah, it hasn't worked out very well so far. So I do think you're right, that it's part, how are you going to let the world in? How are you going to, that you have, that we don't write in a convent, or I don't, and that is the same with bad days. You don't write poems by tuning out the world, but there's some kind of balance, because it's true that I think of that poem space as being far away from the outside world. That's partly why I like going there.
Let me switch the conversation a little bit. How is it living on the East Coast, being that you really grew up or part of like Western United States writing, and now that you're living on the East Coast, has that changed you in many ways, that geographic change?
I've always gone back and forth, but I have very different feelings about the two coasts. When I grew up in the West, I thought my real life was on the East Coast.
Huh.
I thought that's where everything, I mean, the East Coast was a complete fantasy to me. But I thought that's where I would make my life. And so when I moved to Ithaca to go to Cornell in graduate school, actually, I didn't know where Cornell was when I applied there.
You thought it was a big city?
I just had no idea. The East was kind of a magical blur to me. But I love intellectual life and arts life on the East Coast, Western landscape is in my bones and in my body, and I need both. And I've never found one place where I could get both. And I find that really frustrating. Mm-hmm. So I've spent time on both coasts a lot. And in my ideal life that I'm not going to get, I think, I would live part of the year in Seattle and part of the year in Manhattan to satisfy both those impulses. Mm-hmm. It's not as if there isn't landscape out here. It's just so small to me compared to...
It's true.
And it's not, there's certainly arts life of all kinds in the West, but there's something about the density of it in the Northeast.
Mm-hmm.
And the intensity of it in a place like New York that's really important to me. So the going back and forth, it is frustrating to me that I can't find one place where I feel like has everything.
Well, it probably feeds your creativity and your poetry itself. I know Philip Levine lives half the year in Fresno
exactly.
and the other half in Brooklyn, right by the bridge, so he can think of Hart Crane every time he crosses.
And I totally understand why he wants to be both places.
Absolutely. Let me ask you about your, go back to Sharp Stars, his book that I really love. The poems are very quiet. They're very quiet, I noticed you write a lot of them in couplets, and I'm wondering if that is a form that just kind of comes to you, or is it something that you're comfortable with, or tell us about that.
I like couplets because I like all the white space. Half of the poem is silence. I mean, a third of the poem is silence, and I like that. I always feel like I talk too much, so... One of the things I love about poetry is it makes me leave stuff out. And writing in couplets is you can't be too chatty because all that white space makes every word stand out.
That makes sense.
It helps me get the clutter out. It's one of the ways it functions. So that even tercets, be it the three-line stanza, feel a little, I'm always a little nervous. Am I talking too much?
In some of your poems, you indent the second line. Like in, you'll have the first line, which is all the way to the left, and then the second line, the line that comes after that, is indented for three or four spaces, and then you go back and forth, and you indent every other line. For people who don't know poetry very well, what effect does that indention have on the rhythm or on the reading of the poem?
I was thinking that the only ones where I do that. I wish I would move stuff around more on the page.
Right.
I feel kind of timid about that, and as if I'm clinging to something, that left-hand margin. In this book, there are several poems that are in three-line stanzas where each of the three lines is indented. It's a William Carlos Williams used that.
Mm-hmm.
That's a form on the page I really like because it feels and looks very musical to me. And it's almost as if each stanza is a line, but the line keeps stepping down. So, or it feels kind of dancey to me. I don't. It's anyway. It's a form I like. I haven't used it much, but I did just notice that a poem called Sawdust.
Right. That was the one I was thinking of.
Yeah, which is really where the title of the book comes from. Sharp
Yes.
Stars is in there. I don't know how that happened. I can't remember.
Would it be read differently if it wasn't indented? Like, for example, you have this, "Only now do I see that the air is full of small, sharp stars pinwheeling through every living thing that gets in their way." Does the indention cause the reader to read it differently?
I think there's a big difference between the voice reading in our heads when we're reading on the page.
Right.
And what, you know, probably there's no difference if I read that out loud. But that white space at the beginning of each indented line matters to me.
Well, also, it's visually pushing us forward.
Yeah. But there's also kind of more, it's like a double line break in a way because there's white space
Right.
of the line. And then there's more white space. So each line is set off more by the white space. So I think of it as more both pushing forward, but there's also more of a pause. So I guess I have a sense that it's more, in a way, more thinking out loud.
I really like your idea of that white space so that it gives it a quieter feel, and you're not being as chatty, and you're distilling, which is something that I want to take a look at. I think a lot of my poetry has everything in it but the kitchen sink. that's actually true. And I think, well, maybe I should distill a little more. Maybe I should try that. So, yeah.
Well, and of course, I think maybe I should put in the kitchen sink more. I love Albert Goldbarth's poem.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Me too.
And here's somebody who puts in the kitchen. He was actually supposed to read here last night.
Oh.
And my grad students have been reading him all semester. And
where are you teaching?
I'm teaching two places. I'm teaching a couple of classes at Emerson College. So, and then I'm on the grad faculty at the low residency MFA at Lesley.
Is Sharp Stars, did you set out to write a book, or were you just writing poems and then after a while you realized you had a book?
No, I think very much in terms of books, because I like that. Years ago I said to a novelist friend of mine, how can you work on something that big and that long? And she said, how can you start over every day?
Touche.
Isn't that great?
Yeah.
And I hate starting over every day. So I figured that out early on. After the first book, that was a complete miscellany, the way I think a lot of first books are.
Right.
I thought, man, I don't like this. And after that, I had more of a sense of, I know James Tate once talks about going into a mine and finding a vein of ore and following that until it's exhausted, and then he has a book. But I like book-length poems. It helps me enormously to have a sort of approach or something I'm thinking about or working on, a vein on mining. So I think totally in terms of books at this point.
And I do too. I'm really happy to hear you say that. And maybe it's because I also write novelists, but there's my poems are not narrative, but there is a narrative arc that ties the book together, and I think that's important.
Right.
It's one of the reasons I love C.D. Wright.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah. We had her on the show.
Deep Step Come Shining is one of the best books I've ever read in my life.
Me too.
Yeah, me three.
Gorgeous, and it's just haunting, and it takes a whole book. So I love working that way. This book was, I actually took a break from writing poems. I had a big tantrum at one point. I had written Flying Blind. I couldn't get it published. It took 5 years to get it published. I knew it was a lot better than the first two books. And before I could get Flying Blind published, the first two books went out of print. So, I mean, you know, it happens to most poets, but I thought, well, I devoted my life to poets. I was also living in Memphis and very unhappy about that. And I thought, wow, I devoted my life to this, and look where it got me. I'm not going to do it anymore. My brilliant idea was that I was going to somehow write for money.
Oh, yeah.
I haven't figured that out yet, but that was my thought.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll write for money. And I just stopped writing poems. And I didn't know if I would ever start writing poems again. It wasn't, I just thought, that's okay, I'm not going to do that. I wrote everything else, including prose poems, but I wasn't going to go near that poetry stuff. And then there was a point where I wasn't even reading a lot of poetry. Then I started reading it again. And then it was really kind of strange. There was a week, actually a day, when I thought, wait a minute, I wrote three poems this week. So Sharp Stars is a book of joy. There's a lot of sorrow and grief in the book before it, because three friends of mine had died within 2 years of each other. So Flying Blind has a lot of sadness. But Sharp Stars, I mean, the cover art is called Joy Sparks of the Gods. It's a painting by Hans Hoffman. And it's that incredible pleasure of being back living in words again. It's just so easy to get distracted by the wrong stuff, I think.
We'd like to read a poem every week, and when we have a poet on the show, we'd like to ask them to read. Would you read one of your poems from Sharp Stars?
Sure. Do you want to pick? I'll read anything.
Body and Soul is good.
Body and Soul. Let's do that one, yeah.
Okay. Body and Soul. They grow up together, but they aren't even fraternal twins. They quarrel a lot about where to go and what to do. The body complains about having to carry the soul everywhere, as if it were some helpless cripple. And the soul snipes that it can go places the body never dreamed of. Then they quarrel over which one of them does the dreaming. But the truth is, they can't live without each other, and they both know it. Anima, animosity. The diaphragm pumps like a bellows, and the soul pulls out all the stops. Sings at the top of its lungs, laughs at its little jokes. It would like to think it has the upper hand and can leave whenever it wants. But only as long as it knows the door will be unlocked when it sneaks back home before the sun comes up. And when the body says, "Where have you been?" the soul says with a smirk, "I was at the end of my tether." And it was like a diver on the ocean floor or an astronaut admiring the view from outside the mothership. And like them, it would be lost without its air supply and protective clothing. The body knows that and begins to hum, "I get along without you very well." And the soul says, "Listen to that. You can't sing worth a lick without me." They'll go on bickering like this until death do them part. And then, even if the soul seems to float above the body for a moment, like a flame above a candle, once you pinch the wick, it disappears.
That was Sharon Bryan reading Body and Soul.
From her book Sharp Stars, winner of the Isabella Gardner Poetry Award in 2009.
Thank you, Sharon, for joining us on Words on a Wire.
Oh, it's been nothing but a pleasure.